Using my GI Bill taught me I can do anything. And seeing me graduate taught my daughter she can too. VA benefits cover tuition, housing, and supplies. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Welcome to the Natural Healing Show. Keep it natural. Be the Natural Healing Show.
Hello, you are listening to the Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one best-selling author. You can find out more about me and my work at CatherineKerrigan.com and UnlimitedEnergyNow.com. While you're there, definitely sign up for my newsletter so you can learn even more about how you can heal yourself naturally. Now, our guest today is Dr. John Abramson. Dr. John Abramson is the author of two books, including Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. Dr. John Abramson does not, unfortunately, have a website, so we can't share that with you. You'll have to listen to his great interview today or read his wonderful books. Welcome, Dr. John Abramson.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, Dr. John Abramson, I've been so looking forward to this conversation because you taught a course at Harvard Medical School about healing and spirituality. So most of our audience will not have the great privilege of taking this course with you. So can you share for us the cliff notes? What are the main points you try to get across to your students in that course?
Good. So the key issue that I wanted to get across to the students at Harvard Medical School is that as they go through their rigorous medical education and get pushed to their limits, their physical, energetic, intellectual limits, learning the complexities of modern medicine, unaware, they were losing touch with the humaneness that brought them to healthcare and to medical school in the first place. And it's well documented that by far the most humanistic of the folks in our medical system are first-year medical students, and particularly first-year medical students who are planning to go into primary care. And that prioritization of the human relationships in medicine goes steadily down as you go from first year to fourth year student to resident to faculty, practicing doc and faculty and so forth. So what I wanted to communicate to the students is that the physical part of medicine, our bodies as machines, taking care of our bodies as machines, which is 99.9% of what medical education is about, is completely inadequate. It's completely inadequate because we're not just bodies. We're subjective human beings. And the interaction between our subjectivity and how the quality of our interaction with our external environment, be it physical with cold or hot, be it social with family and friends, be it cultural with a culture that prioritizes fast food and solutions that you buy, and so forth, that they were getting socialized into this world of mechanistic medicine. And there are two points I wanted to get across. One was that medicine isn't just mechanistic, that who we are and how we're doing in the world has an enormous amount to do with our health. And we can talk about that as we get into the details. But the other issue is that to turn away from the subjectivity, from our own subjectivity, our own quality of experience of being in the world, as if it's not particularly relevant, as if the mechanistic part of medicine was really where the action's at. And if you want to be a real doctor, you focus on that mechanistic part. Well, the truth is, and this was a shocking truth when I learned it as a fellow in family medicine. The truth is that we don't have a clue. We medical doctors don't have a clue what our own individual subjectivity is about. We don't have a clue about how the physics could possibly work of neurons in our brain creating a sense of our being in the world, of our being, our sentient presence in the world. There's no idea in medical science what the origins, what the mechanism of consciousness is. And so we're dealing not just with the body as a machine and the human being as a subjective experience, but we're dealing with the body as a machine on the one hand, and not having a clue what makes us conscious, sentient human beings. And this was getting trained out of the students, and that's why I pursued this course.
Now, I really appreciate everything you're contributing and your viewpoint here. I want to share a personal perspective. I am a medical intuitive healer, and my dear brother, who I love and admire, is an ophthalmologist. He's an eye surgeon in Savannah, Georgia. On an average day, my brother will see 50 to 60 patients every single day. Today, I will see four clients. My shortest session is an hour. So as and my brother has a huge staff, so he's not, unlike me, he's not doing all the work himself. He has all these people who are helping him. So you talk about the problem being the mechanistic view of medicine. How has the financial arrangements, or how have the financial arrangements in Western medicine broken down the human touch in medicine?
Right. And that's key to how this is unfolded, because if you look at the salary distribution of physicians, and medical students are certainly looking at the salary distribution of physicians, and medical students are carrying an average of $200,000 in debt. So they have some skin in the game, so to speak, about the salaries they're going to make by choosing different professions. That said, the professions like your brother is in, and the surgical specialties and the interventional medical specialties get paid an enormously amount more than the primary care docs do. In the United States, we spend about half as much on primary care as other wealthy nations do that perform much better than we do on healthcare. So philosophically, the students are being taught that being a real doctor is taking care of people's bodies as machines. And the money follows that, because when you take care of bodies as machines, you can make a lot more money than when you take care of human beings as a mix of a physical body and a subjective self that's a mystery. And encountering that mystery, and that's really where this goes with healing and spirituality, is getting into that mystery space with patients. So, and I think it's not a coincidence that the easily quantifiable procedures that create higher salaries are supported by the whole medical industrial complex, because that's where they make their money. They don't make their money from primary care doctors getting to deeply know their patients and being able to help their patients understand how their health has to do with how they're living their life in the world that they've been given. So it's a distorted system that doesn't reward primary care docs, and it doesn't reward the key here in terms of healing and spirituality. It doesn't reward getting into that mystery space with another human being, where the doctor and the patient can encounter each other as equal human beings, not equal in medical knowledge, but equal in existential value, encounter each other as equal beings, and then take that the magic that happens in that relationship and leverage it in a therapeutic context. Now, when I talk like that to physicians, they say, "You're just out of your mind. You know, Catherine, you're seeing four patients a day, and your brother's seeing 55 patients a day, and he's probably making five times more than you are per patient. And you're out of your mind that you can't do that, but you can do that. I know you can do that because I did that. I was a primary care doctor. I was a family doc in a small town for 20 years. And I know that I can't spend an hour with a patient like you do, as a primary care doc. But I know that the relationships that I built with my patients were cumulative over time. So I could pick up a conversation that I had 3 months ago, leave myself a little note to remind myself where we were, but I could pick up that relationship 3 months later and continue it, take it another step forward. So the idea that doctors can't relate to their patients in this mutual, in the spirit of mutual presence and subjectivity, mutual subjectivity. It's a myth, and it's a myth that is perpetrated by, I think, the authority of the healthcare, of the medical establishment. We studied hard, we earned our degrees, and we have a certain amount of authority, and damn it, we're going to use that authority, and we're going to make sure everyone knows about that authority on the one hand. And on the other hand, a lack of awareness that bodies aren't just machines. And the part of the body that isn't just a machine, that's an experiencing sentient being, is a complete mystery and will remain a mystery. So if we want to do this, we've got to dive into the mystery, not solve a problem that can fix the broken parts of the patient's body alone. Sometimes we have to do that. If you're in a cardiac arrest situation, you're not going to be trying to talk to the patient about the quality of their family life. But most of the time, whatever's going on medically is a mix of that mysterious subjectivity and the objectivity of our body as a machine.
Great observations. And, you know, again, I love and admire and respect my brother. And I don't know how he does it, honestly. You know, even though he has a staff who prepares everybody to see 50 to 60 people every single day, I know it's quite stressful. So, and I've also witnessed my brother in action. I've gone to him, he's checked my eyes. I've taken friends of mine there for cataract surgery, and I've observed him, and he's very kind and he's very patient. And that's got to be a stress on the doctor to see to have to see so many people every day to cover all the overhead.
Well, it's our system. The overhead's high, but it's our system that drives that volume. In a practice like the practice I went into in 1982 when I started in medicine, where we owned our own practices and we worked for ourselves, we could decide how hard we wanted to work. And if we wanted to see 20 patients a day, we could do that. And if we wanted to see 40 patients a day, we could do that. So it was an individual choice about how hard you wanted to work. Now, there's a little bit of a difference with the work that your brother is doing. I just had a cataract operation a few months ago, and God bless my ophthalmologist. I mean, I can see so well, and I've never seen so well in my life, and I'm still having fun getting used to it. But that doesn't mean that the procedures have to be reimbursed so disproportionately much higher than docs who spend time with people and get to know them and base their therapeutic approach on the deeper knowledge of who they are as people. It doesn't mean that we have to give that up. It's a decision we, when we talk about a doctor seeing a patient and seeing them out of the context of their lives and just seeing them as a machine. We doctors can allow ourselves to be in that position in relationship to the medical context that we're in and just think about the getting just taking care of our patients' bodies and not their being. And that's a decision that we have to make. And anyone who is out at work in the world makes that decision about how much time goes into relationship and kindness and goodwill about the future, and how much time goes into just clicking another patient off and depositing the money in the bank.
And with that, let's take a break and listen to a message from one of our commercial sponsors here at UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. And we're listening to Dr. John Abramson talk about the course that he taught at Harvard Medical School about healing and spirituality. We'll be right back.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Dr. John Abramson, one of the basic principles of natural healing is that body, mind, and spirit are intimately connected. Now, traditional Western medicine suggests that only its approach is based on the scientific method. It's as if we treat people based on two entirely different approaches. So, for example, as a medical intuitive healer, when I do a medical intuitive reading, I read what I call the five levels of the body. The physical body, which is what traditional medicine focuses on, traditional Western medicine. The energy body, which includes the chakras, the acupuncture meridian, and the breath. The emotional body, which is actually the largest part of a person, according to my system, because emotions can shut down anything. Your mental body, which is your thoughts and belief, and finally, your spiritual body, which is the eternal aspect of ourselves. How can we balance these two different approaches to healing?
Well, I think we have to undo some of the miseducation that we doctors have received in our training and had to at least appear to us to integrate into our thinking about healthcare. We have to undo that. And let me just share with you, I think, one of the most fascinating studies that was ever done. It was done in the 80s. It was the coronary artery drug study. And the issue was, did a drug called Atramid S, did the people who took Atramid S to lower their cholesterol do better than the people who were in the placebo group? And a unique feature of this study is that they counted how many pills people took. They had them bring their bottle of pills, be it Atramid S or placebo, to each visit. And the researchers noted how the patients were doing on placebos and the cholesterol-lowering drug. And they noted how much the patients, to what extent the patients were complying with their therapy, be it placebo or Atramid S. And what they found is that Atramid S did lower cholesterol, but it did not improve health. It was a pre-statin drug, and we can get into the statin drugs. We've talked about that a little. We can go back there again. But it lowered cholesterol, but it didn't improve longevity for these folks. But the researchers had counted to see who took their Atramid S and who took their placebo. And the patients who took their placebo faithfully more than 80% of the time had 1/1,000,000th as the decrease in their, let me start again. Looking at the patients who took their placebo compared to the patients who didn't take the patients who took their placebo did much better. Now, placebo is nothing. It's an inert pill, a fake pill. They did much better. How much better did they do? The difference between the longevity of the people who took their placebo and didn't take their placebo, the chance of that happening just randomly is one in a billion. One in a billion. So the people who took the placebo were far more likely to have good health than the people who didn't take their placebo. And a critical part of this study is it was a randomized controlled trial. So when we do observational studies about people who take their pills or don't take their pills, well, people who don't take their pills may not care as much about their health, and they may be in socially less fortunate situations, and they may not trust their doctors and so forth. So you can't do an observational study about who does better, who chooses to take their pills, and who doesn't choose to take their pills. But this is a randomized study. So the deck was shuffled, and people were assigned to placebo or not placebo. And the people in the placebo group decided whether they were going to take their pills or not. And those people who took their pills did so much better that was a less than a one out of a billion chance that that difference would have occurred just in random. So what does that say? A, it says we were taking pills, we were prescribing pills to lower cholesterol that weren't doing any good, and we didn't know it. And Western medicine isn't infallible. But the other thing that it says is that people's belief systems are enormously important in how their health unfolds. And in this case, it was more important than the therapy that was being given. So when you talk about five levels of therapeutic attention, and the Western doctors say, phooey, I want to know what the potassium level is, and I want to know what the blood pressure is, and I want to know what the EKG looks like. And those are the people who are wrong, that the five levels of healing, and you can, there are different schema to divide it into three or five or seven, whatever, but those other levels that describe our other ways of being in the world are as important as what the Western medicine intervention is. William Osler, the great doctor who was the bridge between old-timey medicine in the late 1800s and new medicine at Johns Hopkins, said it's far more important to know what kind of to know it's far more important to know what kind of person has the disease than what kind of disease the person has. And Louis Pasteur, perhaps the greatest biological scientist of all time, the French scientist who developed vaccines initially, he said he became his initial fame derived from his development of the germ theory when he found out that silkworms, he grew silkworms, and certain silkworms got an infestation of a fungal infection and it killed them. And he became famous, totally the world famous, because he found the cause of disease was the germ, this fungus that the silkworms got. And at the end of his career, he said that what matters most is not the fungus and the silkworm, it's the environment, it's the milieu that the silkworm is living in. More than the germ is the milieu. So what you're feeling, Catherine, as an intuitive healer, what I felt as a family doctor and a primary care physician was the denial, if not sort of aggressive diminishment of that broader view by the Western medicine establishment, when in fact it is that broader view that leads to better health. And that's, we've talked in previous sessions, if any of the current listeners didn't hear those sessions, American medicine is supposed to be the most advanced in the world. And for this most advanced medicine, we pay an excess $2 trillion a year compared to what the other wealthy nations spend, very much including the UK. So we're spending $2 trillion a year to provide the most advanced medicine in the world. And we are doing by far, we have by far the worst health in the developed countries. The other developed countries, since 2000, the other wealthy de developed countries have gained about 2 years in healthy life expectancy. And since 2000, in America, the healthy life expectancy has gone down 1.4 years since 2000. So we're spending a fortune, we're providing the most advanced care, and Americans are not only not just keeping up with the improvements in the other Western wealthy countries, but we're actually losing ground in terms of our own healthy life expectancy. We're living 1.4 years less in good health now than we did in 2000. So, and I can't get this message out. The news won't carry this message. Go back. Today's subject is mind-body medicine, but this subject is a key, and not taking this subject on head-on, this false presumption that biotech innovation is the way to good health. Sometimes it is, but that alone doesn't do it. And in the United States, we're doing this natural experiment where we're wasting $2 trillion a year, and an excess 1 million Americans are dying every year because our health is so bad. And it's the turning away from the broader view of what health is. We're not just clock mechanisms that where a gear gets stripped, and you just got to put in a new little gear wheel and fix the watch, and voila, you got a healthy watch. That's not what we are. We're much broader than that. And not allowing this mystery of our subjectivity being in the world to be part of this project of trying to improve people's health, it's like the white settlers taking over the Native Americans' lifestyle. The Native Americans were in harmony with nature, and we want to prevail over nature, and we've imposed that. And that desire to prevail over nature is an integral part of the philosophy of Western medicine.
Now, I want to go back to what you mentioned with the research with the silkworms, and that was Louis Pasteur, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And you pointed out that he felt that the environment is the most powerful factor. And as a medical intuitive healer, I 100% agree with that philosophy that your environment is the most powerful factor. And that is something that I think gets overlooked both by traditional Western medicine and by many holistic practitioners. So, what is your environment? Your environment is your home, your environment is your work, your environment is the workspace that you're living in. Your environment is your cellular environment, like what's going on at the cellular level. Your environment is your emotions, right? Because if I'm constantly thinking depressing thoughts, then I'm creating poor neurochemistry, right? My environment is my thought processes. And my environment is also my relationship to spirituality, to that deeper, most meaningful aspect of myself, right? So, environment, in my view, as a medical intuitive healer, it's an even bigger picture than all that, right? And the example that I give is I grow orchids. And I have my healing room, in fact, is full of orchids. So if you walk in the room, it's full of light, full of orchids. People feel better just literally walking into the room before I do anything. And I remember earlier I thought, oh, I'm pretty good orchids, and I'd put them in different spots around my house, and they just didn't prosper the way they do in my healing room. What's special about my healing room? It's south-facing. Huge windows full of light, perfect temperature, perfect humidity. It's the environment. And when you place an organism in the optimal environment, that's when it's going to thrive. That's when it's going to be most healthy. And you could take my most beautiful orchid, put it in the dark, don't water it, and it will absolutely die. And yet we whether you're in traditional medicine or alternative healing, we forget it's not just taking the supplement. It's not just taking the drug.
Absolutely, it's absolutely true. That's as reductionist as Western medicine is, as the biotech, whiz bang medicine is. And when Louis Pasteur said, "I've gotten credit for developing the germ theory of disease, but it's the environment that is most important," what he was really saying is that, just as you're saying, to whether you give a pill that's got a patent and costs $1,000 a month, or whether you give a natural supplement that doesn't have a patent and costs $10 a month, you're still sort of fixing the machine without altering, without creating a more constructive, peaceful, rewarding, meaningful relationship of the person to his or her environment. And what Pasteur was saying is, you can't just look at the germs. You can't just look at the silkworms. You can't just look at the environment. It's all of a piece. It's all of a piece. We're not separate from our environment. We are part of our environment. We're in our environment. And that's the way deep healing, much deep healing, has to work. And there are some things, of course, where I had a problem. I had a serious cardiac arrhythmia that the docs couldn't solve. And it was a wonderful thing that they figured out how to solve it. It was actually technology that came from South America, but it's a wonderful thing. I wouldn't be here today without that. But for the most part, healing a human being is helping them to find meaning in their environment, given their own predispositions and their previous trauma and the irrationality of the environment, be it climate issues or whatever issues. It's to find meaning in the environment that we live in, the social, cultural, physical place that we live. And that's what genuine healing is. And I think we could, you and I could use vastly different language, but the five levels of healing that you're talking about are the five levels of healing that I worked with in my practice. In fact, the way I got into this healing and spirituality course in Harvard, I was teaching primary care students from Harvard Medical School in my office about an hour north of Boston. And there was a student who came to me, she's a very good student, and watched the way I practiced. They'd come one afternoon a week for 9 months. And she had a deep spiritual practice. She identified as a Buddhist, and that was very important to her. And she defined for me that what I was doing with my patients was a spiritual encounter. I didn't use that language at all until she spotted it. And she's an activist, and she started this course, and she invited me to lecture in it. And when I gave my first lecture, the papers were shaking like this, and I was nervous as hell to be in front of a bunch of Harvard medical students talking about this sort of soft stuff that they're not used to hearing about. But that evolved into the understanding that you've gotten to, Catherine, about the way you separate the levels of healing. And in fact, she was right. That's what I was doing. I didn't know I was doing it. I thought I would have defined it at the time as being a good listener and getting to know my patients and understanding that my patients, what the issues that they carry in their life, be it their grandchildren or their cancer or their economic situation, whatever it is, whatever has meaning in their life, was what I should attend to. That's the way I got to it. You got to it by a more direct path, I think.
And with that, let's take a break and listen to a message from one of our commercial sponsors here at UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. We're listening to Dr. John Abramson about his course at Harvard Medical School about healing and spirituality. We'll be right back.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good. station that makes you feel good.
Dr. John Abramson, I love that you talk about how every therapeutic transaction, every therapeutic relationship, whether it's with your therapist, with your doctor, or your medical intuitive healer, could be a spiritual encounter. I want to ask you also, in your experience, about the therapeutic value of a spiritual practice. So I'm going to tell you a story. So I was talking to a client of mine recently, and I always thought of this person as a spiritual person. Well, when I talked to her, she doesn't have a prayer practice. She doesn't have a meditation practice. She doesn't go to church. And I was sort of surprised, right? And not that those are the only way to do spirituality, but I find so much value in my prayer practice, in my meditation practice, and my communication with my angels and asking for guidance. And of course, the audience listening to this broadcast will come from many different spiritual backgrounds. So in your professional opinion, what is the medical healing value of having a spiritual practice?
Well, I think let's define spiritual very broadly, like your friend did.
Mm-hmm.
And let's define spiritual as opening up to the energy that you feel as a being in the universe. And you can define that in religious terms, to be with the God that you believe in, and that brings you in that direction. You can define it in purely meditative terms or yoga terms. You could define it as being deeply affected by a walk on a beach. And I think the different ways to define it are finite and necessarily incomplete descriptions of the experience. I think the core of the experience is finding meaning in your being in this world alive, in this universe alive. Mm-hmm. And whatever metaphors people want to use to describe that, from deeply religious to atheistic, it doesn't matter what words they use. What matters is the experience of being in the world. And then, very importantly, it's the experience of being with another human being who's cognizant that their spirit, for lack of a better word, spiritual existence is being enhanced by the mutual recognition that you're sharing in this mystery together, not predefining each other, not assuming you know what that person's going to say or do or feel, but of being in that moment of mystery together, I think is amongst the highest spiritual experiences that you can have. So words don't do a good job. Our being tells the story, and we describe, each of us has a set of words that we use to describe our being, but it's that level of being that's the key.
Great insights. And if I could put it perhaps simply, when I do my spiritual practice, I experience deep inner peace. And whenever we are in a state of deep inner peace, then we're in a state of energetic coherence. And what energetic coherence looks like from a medical healing perspective, your EKG, your EEG goes into this beautiful rhythm where you're not producing stress hormones, where your serotonin is going up, your stress hormones are going down, and you're in an alpha state. And we know from scientific research that your body heals when you're in an alpha state. So I personally feel that anyone who really wants to heal would do better if they develop their own spiritual practice, whatever that looks like for you. Like you said, whether it's walking on the beach, reading spiritual books, meditating, praying, talking to your angels. There's
Talking to our friends and our
talking
family.
to our friends. Absolutely. Now,
I told a story in my first book, Overdosed America, about a nun with whom I became very friendly. She was my patient. And she, Sister Marguerite, she's a wonderful lady. And she was my patient. And I had the relationship with her that I described before, where we didn't spend hours talking with each other, but we carried on a conversation over time as I saw her for routine medical things. And as I got to know and trust her better, I got braver about broaching this very issue with her. And finally, one day I said to her, Sister Margaret, she took me to, she was a retired teacher and she lived with retired nuns, and they had a beautiful retreat with a chapel, so a convent. And I said to her, when you're in your convent meditating, because we had gotten to the point where she had described her meditations with a religious orientation, I said, when you're in your chapel meditating, and I'm in my bedroom meditating, do you think, excuse me, do you think we're doing the same thing? Do you think we're having the same experience? And she said, absolutely, absolutely. And it was just such a wonderful moment for me.
yes. And going back to this broader picture of spirituality and healing, one thing that I've learned over the years is people may not remember what I say, but people will definitely remember how you make them feel.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, right.
Right? And so, how can we help people to feel better, which is the essence of healing, right? And ways of helping people feel being helping people feel better, kindness, compassion, deep inner listening.
Right. Receptivity to their being, to their state of being,
Yes.
and connect on that level.
Yes. So you have taught this wonderful course at Harvard Medical School about healing and spirituality. How do you personally look at a patient who comes to you for treatment?
Well, I would go back to the words of William Osler, Sir William Osler, and say the first step is to know who the patient is, to get to know who the patient is, so that you can understand what they're saying, what the importance of what they're saying is. And then the challenge of being a primary care physician, and challenge it is to listen to this with an open mind and to try to figure out whether this is a situation where I need to turn more attention to the biomedical model, whether I need to at least temporarily look at that body as a machine and say, what's wrong here? Whether I need to be completely open to the quality of their experience because it's poisoning them, and they whatever's bothering them, they're not going to get better until they can figure out how to cope with their environment better. And anywhere in between, and that's what being a primary care doc is you are anywhere in between. So I think it's the openness, and you can do both things at the same time. I'm sure you've had the experience of being seriously ill and encountering a doctor who looked at you as a real person and felt that beneficence. As the doctor described what kind of surgery or drug or IV or whatever he or she was going to give you. I was once at a Buddhist medicine conference, and I asked the folks, they were beautiful folks, the Tibetan Buddhists, and I asked them, what should I do when a patient is demanding an antibiotic? Through my training and experience, that an antibiotic isn't what they need. And they're demanding. And the answer was, give the antibiotic with love. And though giving extra medicines isn't advisable, building a foundation of trust and respect is the key.
Great information. And I would do the same thing. Right? And you know, one of the things so many of my clients are fearful of a medical approach, and I re recommend they actually pray. And I have a client right now who's in the hospital. He was in a severe bike accident, broke many bones in his body, and the doctors wanted to give him a CT scan. And I'm like, do the CT scan. He was afraid of the dyes, right? And I'm like, they need this information to know how to treat you. And you need the information to understand what's going on. And so I advised him. I said, pray over this. I said, when they give you the dye, pray over it. And it's a very simple prayer. And I've come from a Christian tradition. Heavenly Father, I ask that my mind, body, and spirit take from this medication, take from this treatment, take from this surgery, everything for my highest good, and that my mind, body, and spirit gently and easily release anything that is not for my highest good. And I ask that this be done in the name of Jesus Christ. May thy will be done. So we need to lose the fear and trust and ask that we take what we need from all these therapeutic experiences.
Right. That's what that study that I was describing about giving the medicine, the cholesterol lowering medicine that didn't work, and the people who took their placebo did so much better than the people who didn't take their placebo. And in essence, in our Western limited way, that is the prayer. When you take your placebo, this was the study that proved it. When you take your placebo, you get better.
And with
It
that,
helps you. You don't get all better every time, but it helps you to be healthier.
you've been listening to the Natural Healing Show for UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Kerrigan, medical intuitive healer, Amazon number one bestselling author. We've been listening to Dr. John Abramson, who has taught a course at Harvard Medical School about healing and spirituality. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, when you connect to your deep innermost eternal self, you can heal yourself naturally. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Natural Healing Show. Keep it natural with the Natural Healing Show.